This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Given the way things have been going in Washington lately, this seems like a pretty tall order.
We will have financial reform adopted this year in the Congress of the United States.
Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd's plan to make that happen on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 15th of March, and it is good to have you here. 18 months to the day after Lehman Brothers went under and a couple of trillion dollars in government bailouts and lost private investments later, today Senator Christopher Dodd gave us his plan to make sure that never happens again. Actually, wait a minute, because that's not true. In his press conference this morning, Dodd made a point of saying there is no way to prevent another financial crisis. About the best we can do is make sure it's a whole lot less painful. We start with Brett Neely in Washington.
Senator Dodd's message was clear to Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics.
He is determined to do everything he can, including making compromises with which he is uncomfortable, so that if the legislation falters, it cannot be deemed his fault.
But in an interview after unveiling the plan, the senator said the compromises were worth it.
Mature adults, reasonable people, can reach intelligent compromises on these matters so the American public will have the benefits of this bill.
Dodd's bill would create a council of regulators to look out for risky behavior. The Federal Reserve would see its powers widened. The strong new Consumer Protection Bureau would be housed there. And the Fed would oversee a wide array of financial firms, including big insurance companies like AIG. The central bank's new powers come despite dropping the regulatory ball as the financial bubble formed, says Petru.
The Fed has not covered itself with distinction in the current crisis, but none of the other regulators has either.
One of the most important parts of Dodd's plan is called resolution authority. The idea is to close failing banks without bringing the financial system down. Financial firms would pay a total of $50 billion up front to clean up any future wreckage. Simon Johnson was chief economist at the IMF. He sees a big hole in that proposal.
The key issue is the resolution authority is a U.S. resolution authority. The big banks that we're worried about, these are cross-border.
Johnson, who's written the new book 13 Bankers, says bank lobbying has gutted much of the overall proposal. For example, shareholders would get to vote on executive pay, but the vote would be non-binding.
Rearranging the chairs on the regulatory Titanic is a largely pointless exercise.
The Senate Banking Committee will start work on the bill next week. Then Dodd's fellow senators will get a chance to prove whether they're as mature and reasonable as he hopes. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
All right, if that's what's in the Dodd plan, what does it all add up to? To help us figure that out, we called Hal Scott at Harvard Law School. He teaches law and finance there, as well as capital markets regulation. Professor Scott, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Kai.
The president said this afternoon that Senator Dodd's proposal was, in essence, a good place to start. What do you think?
Well, I hope we're not starting. I mean, we've been at this for a long time. It's time to get to the finish line, I hope. So I think it's, pretty comprehensive. It's much more than a start.
Let's break it down into its component parts then. First of all, consumer protection. Much has been made of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, whether there will be one or there won't. And in Senator Dodd's plan, there won't. It'll be a branch of the Federal Reserve. Is the consumer well served by this piece of legislation?
I'm disturbed by it. I'm disturbed as to why we are putting this agency, which is, by the way, still supposed to be independent, even though it's within the Federal Reserve. That is, it's got its own rulemaking authority. Nobody at the Fed can tell it to do anything, but it's at the Federal Reserve. Could be in the Treasury. Could be its own agency. I don't see the rationale for it. But I know that Senator Corker, in negotiations with Senator Dodd, felt strongly, for reasons I don't completely understand, that it should be in the Fed. But the whole criticism in the past has been that the banking agencies haven't really served the consumer because they haven't made consumer protection a priority. So why are we putting this in the heart of a banking agency, even though the banking agency has no power over it? It's an odd solution.
Here's a trillion-dollar question for you, Professor. Senator Dodd said he's going to take care of too big to fail, and we're going to have ways to unwind these big banks if they risk bringing down the entire economy. What about the prospect of more taxpayer dollars going to bail out these big banks? Anything in there that's going to take care of that?
I think there should be a lot more in there than is in there. Let me tell you what I see. Continued authority for the Treasury to bail out systemically important institutions, which, of course, is what it did to some extent during the crisis. I see continued authority for the Fed to lend in, you know, crisis situations, although it's a little bit more constrained than it was in the past. So I think on both scores, we still have taxpayer exposure. Now, I'm not one that believes that you could design a bill in which there was, as people in Congress like to refer to it, no foam on the runway. I think we need some foam, but I'd rather have the foam coming from the Treasury Department, from the administration itself, than through the Fed, even though there are provisions in this bill that say the Fed has to report on what they do, et cetera, et cetera. I think inherently the Treasury is much more responsible politically than is the Fed.
The foam on the runway being, you know, a little thing to ease that bad landing, right?
Yeah.
Hal Scott at Harvard Law School. He's also a director of the Committee on Capital Markets Regulation, which does capital markets regulation. Professor Scott, thanks a lot for your time.
Good talking with you, Kai.
On Wall Street today, not a whole lot of change, actually, for like the fourth or the fifth straight day in a row, if you're keeping track. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Federal Communications Commission would like a few moments of your time to talk broadband, that is, high-speed internet access. Today, the FCC released its 10-year proposal for dramatically increasing the speed of the internet in this country, which, as it happens, is not as fast as you might think it is. The plan is sure to set off intense competition among the big telecommunications companies. It's also going to provide some new opportunities for some hungry young upstarts, too. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The FCC plan would boost internet speeds 25 times, but to get there, the internet's backbone will need a major tweak. Companies that make the building blocks of the web will be in great demand. Paul Gallant is a telecom analyst at Concept Capital.
So the companies that build routers and switches and put up wireless towers around the country for mobile broadband, it's really the infrastructure companies that are the clearest winners here.
Companies like Cisco. It's already announced plans for a speedy new router. Google says it'll build a super-fast internet network. The FCC plan isn't even out of the box, and the competition is already fierce.
This is going to be an incredible smackdown over the next few years.
Telecom analyst Gary Arland heads Arland Communications. He says Cisco and Google won't be alone in the ring. The broadband plan could spawn new rivals. Think back 10 years.
You know, we thought that Yahoo and Alta Vista might be the great search engines that would dominate the industry. And then along came this upstart named Google that we'd never heard of.
The FCC's plan is meant to spark innovation. Bruce Gottlieb is chief counsel to the FCC chairman. He says the next Google could be, say, a company that monitors people's vital signs from home over the internet.
Around high blood pressure, heart attacks, other things where detection is really essential. These are all technologies that companies are working on right now, but they depend on connectivity.
And a boost from a government plan for the Internet. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Finance ministers from the 16 countries that share the euro as their common currency had a little tete-a-tete in Brussels, Belgium today. They're trying to figure out how, or perhaps even whether, to bail Greece out of its debt problems. Athens is running a budget deficit that's about three times what's allowed under euro rules. The government has announced huge spending cuts in response, more than $6 billion worth, and that is a popular number elsewhere in Europe, too. Ireland has made its own $6 billion in cuts. And for a country far smaller than Greece, that is a whole lot of pain to spread around. From Dublin, Christopher Worth reports.
The cobblestone pub in downtown Dublin. You sit here, your feet tap to the music, your hand cradles a whiskey, and life feels good. Along the walls, smiling faces beam down from fading photographs. Happy days. In here, you could easily forget that Ireland is suffering through the worst economic downturn in decades. But outside on the freezing streets, times are tough. Just off O'Connell Street, Bujo Viora strikes up an accordion tune from his native Romania. He came to Ireland 7 years ago, before the housing boom turned to a bust. He worked construction jobs back then. Building sites couldn't hire workers fast enough. Today, Viora has to feed his family on the few coins that passersby toss into his hat.
No job. Very difficult to play the accordion. The baby, the 4 foot, no pampers, no milk, no bread. Very difficult.
Over at the Department of Finance, advisor Alan O'Hearn says the government relied too heavily on the tax revenue that rolled in during the housing boom. The bust left a gaping hole in Ireland's finances, and taxpayers had to stump up $80 billion to recapitalize banks that were heavily invested in real estate.
So you don't see as many cranes around. In fact, you see quite a lot of empty apartment blocks and houses. So the economy is going through quite a wretched adjustment, there's no doubt about that.
Last year, Ireland's fiscal deficit reached almost 12% of gross domestic product. That's nearly as bad as Greece. Those debt levels have made it tough to borrow money through government bonds. And as a member of the Eurozone, Ireland doesn't have the option of devaluing its currency to become more competitive and restore growth. What it could do was cut spending, and it's done that with a vengeance. Once praised for its strong economy, Ireland now gets plaudits for its austerity. It's cut government workers' pay, reduced social welfare benefits, and is gradually raising the retirement age from 65 to 68. Next year, it plans to cut a further $5.5 billion from the budget.
We have shown to the markets that we're willing to do what's necessary to put the economy back on a road to recovery, to take the medicine. And I think you're seeing the reward for all that work in that borrowing costs have come down very significantly over the last year.
But civil servants like Geraldine Mangan say the rich aren't paying their fair share. Her wages have been cut by 12%. And she says that's made it nearly impossible to pay for the house that she bought at the height of the market.
I know cutbacks have to be made because they're spending more than they're bringing in. It's just unfortunate that the lower paid civil servants in this country are getting hit. It feels like that they're laughing in our face, really. That's what it feels like.
But the question is, are these deep cuts going to be enough? Leo Varadkar of the opposition party Fine Gael says that by 2015, simply servicing Ireland's debt will gobble up a third of what the government takes in taxes. He says that if the current plan doesn't work, Ireland may have to seek a bailout from the European Union. Or, worse yet, it may even have to consider the unthinkable.
There is a growing debate. It's not a mainstream one by any means, but that we do have to consider potentially the nuclear option of leaving the euro. Like many nuclear events, it might work, but there would be huge casualties in doing so.
The very thought could drive some people to drink. At least, that's what they're hoping back at the cobblestone pub. Though the roar of the Celtic tiger has shrunk to a rattling cough, there is one consolation. The same government that's dramatically cutting public spending has also cut taxes on alcohol. And with St. Patrick's Day just around the corner, that has to strike the right note. In Dublin, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Coming up, a facelift for Shanghai's waterfront.
Pudong across the river has really sprung up. The mean joke back then when you were in Shanghai, this is going to be mean, is that it was Poo Jersey. Because nobody wanted to go there.
But first, let's do the numbers. Those proposed financial regulations we told you about earlier got a mixed market reaction today. The Dow Industrials rebounded from early jitters to pick up 17 points, more than a 10th percent, closed at 10,642. NASDAQ down 5 points, about a quarter percent, finished at 2,362. The S&P 500 tacked on a half a point. That's a fraction of 1%, wrapped up trading at 1150. Investors rode a seesaw with the major banks today. Bank of America dropped more than 25 cents a share before rallying to close even. But Goldman Sachs ended the day lower, about 8/10 percent. Citibank shed more than 2% today. Investors did a Google search on the word sell today after reports that the internet giant could be close to closing its operations in China. Shares powered down nearly 3% today. On the positive side, shares of bailed-out insurance giant AIG picked up about a quarter percent. That after some former employees threatened to sue to get $21 million in promised bonuses the company is now withholding. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard. Reacting to the stock market is investing. Taking stock in long-term is vanguarding. More about vanguarding at vanguard.com. And by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. The trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for the month of February. The Federal Reserve meets for one of its 8 regularly scheduled meetings of the year on interest rates and the economy. And a gathering of hospitable folks. The American Hotel and Lodging Association concludes its annual legislative summit in Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama was out and about pitching his health care overhaul today. As it happens, he was in Ohio this time. But that doesn't really matter very much, because even if the president never does get to wherever you are, you're going to be hearing plenty about health care reform this week. Millions of dollars worth, both for and against it, on television, radio, and in the newspapers. Healthcare is on track to be a record breaker for the amount of ad money spent on a single issue, more than $200 million in the past year and counting. A huge chunk of that cash has come from the pharmaceutical industry. Gregory Warner reports from the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia that Big Pharma may be getting a whole lot less than it paid for.
President Obama made a handshake deal with the pharmaceutical industry last year. The administration would limit industry concessions to just $80 billion over 10 years to help pay for reform. In return, the drug industry would support the Senate health care bill and spend as much as $150 million on advertising in favor of it, with TV ads like this one.
If I get sick, really sick, and got to be hospitalized or something, I stand a chance of losing everything.
I think Americans deserve better. This is one promise the politicians have to keep.
Jack Calfee is with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington.
The ads conveyed an impression
that reform was almost certain to happen this time, even though it failed so miserably in 1993.
Back then, the industry used all its might to campaign against Bill Clinton's reform bill. So what about that deal that Big Pharma made for $80 billion in cuts? The latest version of the health care reform bill has that up to $90 billion. Robert Goldberg is with the Center for Medicine and the Public Interest.
And it doesn't make a difference whether the industry agrees to it or not. It's already in the bill.
He says the drug industry could end up paying a lot more as the House and Senate try to reconcile their bills for a vote expected later this week. And he says if reform does not pass, Congress will still be looking for ways to bring down the cost of health care by making cuts the drug industry tried to avoid, like a bill that would allow Medicare to bargain for cheaper drug prices. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Toyota has clearly decided enough's enough with all the recent reports of unintended acceleration in its hybrid Priuses. The company held a press conference today to say that nobody's been able to recreate the incident from San Diego last week, the one where the highway patrol pulled in front to help that Prius slow down. Some analysts are saying it's about time the company started getting control of this story and reassuring its customers. But Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains that that can be a really tricky balance.
Toyota's critics say that since this crisis began, the company hasn't missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. It took too long to respond to concerns about the recalls, and when it finally did respond, it said all the wrong things. David Margulies is a public relations expert. He says it seems like Toyota's finally getting ahead of this story.
You can certainly point to things that are not true or don't seem to address the issue. And that way you're being proactive. You're out doing something. You're not hiding in a bunker somewhere. And that's what people want to see.
In a lot of ways, this is really a perception issue. Only a few Toyotas have had problems. But that's not the way the public sees it. Toyota's enormous challenge now is to convince people its cars are safe to drive. David Boulay is at PCG Campbell. It's a marketing and communications firm that specializes in the auto industry. He says if last week's incident with the runaway Prius turns out to be a hoax, it could be a good opportunity for Toyota. But the company will still have to handle it carefully.
They still have to be very cautious about being perceived as cavalier or uncaring, that they're not taking all of this responsibly and doing the right thing.
He says it's like Toyota's driving a narrow mountain road. It has to defend itself without sounding defensive.
They have some wind at their back now, and they have some third-party endorsers, so it's not just their investigation.
At the press conference today, Toyota said preliminary findings were inconsistent with the driver's account and that there should be a further investigation into that driver's story. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Now that the Olympics are over, the next big happening on the global events calendar is the 2010 World Expo. It's going to be held in Shanghai in a couple of months. So the city has restored its famous waterfront, the Bund, as it's known. The Bund has been at the center of Shanghai's economy for 80-plus years now, and city officials are banking on it being a centerpiece for the future, too. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on the line with us now to talk Bund. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
This is a very visual story that we're going to do on the radio here. So paint me a picture. What does the Bund look like right now?
Well, as one historian calls it, it's an architectural spectacle on the riverfront of Shanghai. So the next time you come back to Shanghai, Kai, I want you to save up 14 cents.
Okay.
So you can take the river ferry that takes you across the river. Because as you come by, you see some large apartment buildings and office buildings, and suddenly you come across 1 mile of neoclassical European buildings. And that's the Bund. You know, pagodas in this part of China. I mean, to explain it to you, one of the buildings has this giant dome, almost like the Capitol building. And then next to that, you have Asia's tallest clock tower, you know, which is, you know, looks a little like Big Ben. And then the other buildings have these great pillars in the front of it. What it screams to the visitor is, you know, this is China's original international city. And when you go into the buildings, you've got the most expensive restaurants in some of them and bars. There's the Armani store. So, I mean, this is, you know, glitzy Shanghai, and they're trying to fix it up to bring as many people over during the expo, Kai.
Well, tell us more about that. What are they doing to jazz this place up? I mean, the buildings are gorgeous, as you described, but last time I was there, they were kind of run down.
You've got five-star hotels putting in a ton of money. The Fairmont Hotel Group is opening a historic hotel called the Peace Hotel in Shanghai. Mm-hmm. The Peninsula Hotel is old Shanghai money, and they're going to open up a hotel. Waldorf Astoria is going to come. So you've got a lot of private companies putting a whole lot of money into this, as well as the government of Shanghai.
So you know what I never understood was why in 1949, when the communists took over, and then through the Cultural Revolution and all the turmoil that China went through, why didn't they tear down these monuments, really, to Western capitalism and imperialism?
Well, I've talked to historians about it, and the best answer I can get is, you know, they're really nice. And we didn't want to knock them down. I mean, Shanghai people will tell you that they're proud of this. I mean, this reminds them of the golden age in the 1930s of Shanghai, the most international city, and, you know, it still aspires to be today.
Yeah, and it's interesting because now you stand on the Bund and you put your back to those buildings. You look across the river and you see this area called Pudong, which when I was in Shanghai 10 or 12 years ago was basically a cement factory and some cows. And now it is the most unbelievable collection of glass and steel skyscrapers you're ever going to see.
Pudong across the river has really sprung up. The mean joke back then when you were in Shanghai, this is going to be mean, is that it was Poo Jersey.
Oh, man.
Because nobody wanted to go there. And now, just like on the Jersey side of the financial district, all these new glassy buildings have gone up on the Pudong side next to this big needle spire sticking out called the Pearl Tower. Citigroup has a building there, and Standard Chartered from Britain. There's an HSBC bank there. But the tallest one now is called the World Financial Center. So that's what Shanghai wants to be. It's actually on paper. There's a plan for Shanghai in 2020 to become an international shipping and financial center. So they want to kind of return to the glory days of the 1930s when, you know, all the foreign bankers were selling stocks and bonds and currency on the Bund, and they're importing opium into China, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, you got the old and the really, really new in Shanghai. We'll have some links to pictures on our website, also some stories from when we had the show there back in 2006. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Scott Tong is in Shanghai for us. Thank you, Scott.
Okay. You're welcome, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, fodder for the Twitter skeptics among you. The South by Southwest Interactive Festival is happening down in Austin, Texas this week. It's always a hotbed of tweeting, which made today's keynote address by Twitter CEO Evan Williams a huge draw. CNET News reported today that fans were lined up outside to get in, only to go flooding back out once the event actually started. Mr. Williams, it seems, is not the most inspiring speaker to be had. On a related note, my Twitter followers have been telling me I ought to tweet some more, so I'll give it a whack. At Kai Rizdal is the, what, it's a handle, right? Is that what they call it? All right, anyway. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 17 points, more than a tenth of 1%. I knew it was called a handle. The NASDAQ fell 5 points. That's 0.25%. The S&P 500 added less than a point. That's a fraction of 1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow morning to the Marketplace Morning Report if you want the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, the question hospitals continue to wrestle with.
Which of these two alternatives provides more value per dollar spent?
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.